Hello and welcome to Alexander Disease Research Update, episode 19, recorded on February 9th, 2024. I'm Albie Messing from the Waisman Center at the University of Wisconsin, and with me today are Natasha Snyder and Rachel Battaglia. Both Rachel and Natasha have been on before, and Rachel was a graduate student in Natasha's lab at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. So Rachel is now at the Broad Institute at MIT, where she's a postdoctoral fellow in the lab of Ralda Nama. Before we get started, please send feedback and questions to amessing@wisc.edu. Today, our topic is a paper published last year by our two guests entitled Intermediate Filament Dysregulation in Astrocytes in the Human Disease Model of KLH L16 mutation in giant axonal neuropathy, which appeared in the journal Molecular Biology of the Cell. Of course, axons are part of neurons, but this isn't just a disorder of neurons, and it has very important connections to astrocytes and even Alexander disease. So let's start with some basic questions. Maybe Natasha, you could start off. What is giant axonal neuropathy?
So giant axonal neuropathy is an inherited pediatric neurodegenerative disease that is caused by a mutation in a gene called KLHL16, which is also known as GAN, G-A-N. So the disease and the gene sometimes are called the same thing. So we decided to go with the scientific name, which is KLHL16. So this gene is part of a large gene family of 42 members, and many of them have not been well characterized. But the current understanding is that the disease mechanism involves loss of function in this gene, which then leads to abnormal protein accumulation in various cells, but neurons appear to be most vulnerable. And so the name comes, giant axonal neuropathy, or GAN, comes from the fact that these long projections in neurons of patients with GAN have very distended axons, giant axons, because they're filled with proteins that accumulate in the absence of gigaxonin function, which is the protein that's being lost.
So what are the proteins that are accumulating?
So in patients with GAN, the most well characterized substrate of gigaxonin are intermediate filament proteins. And in humans, there are more than 70 intermediate filament genes, that, as we discussed in a prior podcast. And so many of these intermediate filament proteins accumulate in GAN patient cells. In neurons, the main intermediate filament proteins are neurofilaments and perforin. And in astrocytes, the main intermediate filaments that accumulate are GFAP and vimentin. So this is a bit of an oversimplification. So there's more of these proteins that accumulate, but these are sort of the major ones in the two main cell types of the nervous system.
So I mentioned before that this disorder does affect astrocytes, not just neurons. And so GFAP is accumulating in astrocytes, and even in the earliest neuropathology studies that identified giant axonal neuropathy as a distinct disorder back in the 1970s, when people looked at astrocytes, they had Rosenthal fibers, identical to the ones in Alexander disease. And my understanding is that there are some MRI aspects of giant axonal neuropathy that also resemble those of Alexander disease patients. So it really is a very, very interesting disorder. Do GFAP and vimentin interact?
So when GFAP forms these filaments that we're used to seeing in cells, it does so by assembling together with other proteins. So GFAP can homodimerize with itself, or it can heterodimerize with vimentin. So definitely, even, you know, beyond the disease in a normal situation, they're interacting.
So your basic approach was to prepare iPS cells from, I think, seven different patients, although most of your results are derived from one of those cell lines. And you took those iPS cells and you differentiated them in various ways. What you find in the astrocytes, you get aggregates especially concentrated around the nucleus that contain GFAP and perhaps Vimentin. You comment that there are Vimentin aggregates. Are they the same aggregates?
So the interesting thing is that when, and Rachel's going to go through the iPSC methods, but the early immature astrocytes express only Vimentin, and it definitely forms perinuclear aggregates by itself. And then later on, when GFAP comes on board, there are GFAP Vimentin co-staining perinuclear aggregates. You know, the cytoplasm is a crowded space, and you know, we're only looking at two proteins. So whether this colocalization is just simply a function of these two proteins being so abundant and in the same place, or whether they actually directly interact is a question that we haven't touched on yet.
Well, in addition to the iPS cells differentiating into neurons and astrocytes, you prepared organoids. And so perhaps now is a good time for Rachel to explain the difference between the iPS cells and organoids. We've talked about organoids before in a previous podcast, but I think we need a refresher. In your hands and for these experiments, why did you go on to make organoids and how are they different?
So there are many differences in the 2D culture versus three-dimensional organoids. So in 2D, the cells are grown in a flat single layer, but in organoids, they're actually grown in a sphere. And this is thought to provide a microenvironment that's a little more similar to what you would have in vivo. You know, when you grow cells in 2D on a plastic dish, of course, we're adding other things on top of the dish to make it as similar as we can to the brain, but it's still, you know, stiffer than the brain. It's not exactly the same type of situation you'd have in a developing brain. So with the organoids, the cells are growing on top of each other instead. So that's thought to mimic more what you would expect to see in the brain. So the first advantage for organoids is this 2D versus 3D. And then the second advantage is that it's a co-culture system. So when I say that, I mean that we have not just astrocytes by themselves, but there are also neurons in those organoids. And people can look at that in 2D as well. You can culture astrocytes and neurons together, but this is another way to do that in three dimensions. And we didn't do any co-cultures in 2D in our paper.
Did your organoids include oligodendrocytes as well?
We didn't check for oligodendrocyte markers, no. But they definitely did not have microglia.
Did you get fundamentally the same results out of your organoids as opposed to the iPS cells?
Yeah, it was similar. We did minimal characterization for the organoids, so we just kind of looked at the aggregates. But since we didn't look at neurons in 2D, we were able to confirm that there were neurofilament aggregates in the organoids as well.
One of the most interesting findings, I thought, in the paper was your studies on SW13 cells. And we don't need to go through the details of those cells, but the finding was that in order for the aggregates to form, you really needed both GFAP, and I'm talking about the aggregates in astrocytes, you needed both GFAP and Vimentin, that the Vimentin really facilitated formation of the aggregates. Is that a fair way to summarize your results?
I don't know if it's necessarily a requirement, but I think Vimentin definitely promoted the aggregation.
And one of the reasons I'm interested in that is because some years ago, we did some experiments which we haven't published yet, but we crossed our Alexander mice, the point mutants in GFAP, with a knockout lines of Vimentin. So they're not expressing any Vimentin at all. And in vivo, at least, those animals clearly formed Rosenthal fibers. I don't think we could really say whether they were forming more Rosenthal fibers or less. So that would say that Vimentin is not required for it, for sure, but it may very well facilitate it.
Yeah, I think this is why I think having rodent models, which obviously gives you the entire in vivo situation, coupled with human models like the cells and the organoids that Rachel helped develop, are really important, because there are certain human elements that are not in the rodents as we're learning about these diseases. And obviously cells are not individual cells, you can't say much about the physiology. And so stringing data together from the rodent models with these human systems will, I think, be the key to advancing this area of research. So based on Rachel's data, we have made quote unquote humanized mouse models of GAN, where we are trying to replicate some of the elements that are in the human gene that are not in the rodent, hoping that besides this vimentin and GFAP interaction, potential interaction that we found, we can uncover other elements, including messenger RNA and RNA binding proteins that I think will help us complete the mechanism of how these aggregates actually start to form and how they're stabilized.
In thinking about the connections between giant axonal neuropathy and Alexander disease, if in giant axonal neuropathy you have increased levels of GFAP to the point where you're forming Rosenthal fibers, you might think that those patients would have some of the same kinds of problems, clinical problems, that Alexander disease patients have, but that Alexander disease patients would have maybe some similarities to GAN, but some things that are unique because they have a mutant GFAP. Has anyone really tried to put together the clinical features to see where those overlaps are?
Not that I'm aware. So my clinical collaborator, Diane Armeo at here at UNC, she's taking all of these basic science findings and feeding them into the known aspects of the human disease pathology. And we're not there yet, but that's the hope, is that for both of these diseases, there's now a clinical trial for AXD, and there's also a clinical trial for GAN. If we can find aspects of the cellular pathology that are translating into a clinical phenotype, you know, there's always the potential that you could repurpose one therapy for the other disease. I mean, that's the hope, is that you can help the most people possible. And certainly the astrocyte aspect of GAN in terms of the mechanism has not been looked at. As you mentioned, Albie, Rosenthal fibers have been reported from the beginning, from the 70s, and every study that has been published on the neuropathology, Rosenthal fibers are there, but the entire focus has been on the neurons. And, you know, we don't know yet, but we hypothesize that astrocytes are contributing, and there's probably similar mechanisms that actually feed into the clinical phenotype. And there is a natural history study ongoing for GAN that we'll know more about. Obviously, these two being such rare diseases, this is challenging because there are phenotypic variabilities. But even though they're rare diseases, I'm just amazed at everything that we do know and all the models that we have to study. So I think we'll get there.
Another thing you found in your astrocytes was a change in nuclear shape. Can you comment a little bit more about that and whether you also saw that change in nuclear shape in neurons?
Definitely, yeah. So when we looked at the GFAP expression in the astrocytes, we noted that in these cells that had large perinuclear aggregates, that there was actually an effect on the nuclear shape, that it was deformed right adjacent to those aggregates. And this is very similar to phenotype that we saw in our Alexander disease astrocyte model.
As far as your question about the neurons, Albie, we didn't look carefully in the organoid model. We have made iPSC neuron motor neurons from GAN cells. These data are not published yet, but we don't really see the same thing. Most of the aggregates that we see in the neurons are actually in the axon, not in the cell body. And so it is different in astrocytes. And as I mentioned earlier, there is crowding in the cytoplasm, but the nucleus of the cell is very sensitive to mechanical stimuli. You know, there's been some really nice studies where you can isolate nuclei and pull on them and push on them and activate all kinds of signaling. So we think the proximity of these aggregates and whatever interactions they're forming with elements of the nuclear envelope could really have profound effects on cell signaling, gene transcription, movement of proteins and RNA in and out of the nucleus. And in fact, for me, the most striking finding that we found, and it actually wasn't from the iPS astrocyte model, it was from the GAN fibroblasts. So the GAN patient skin fibroblasts also have very nice aggregates that we can look at by immunofluorescence. Interestingly, unlike the astrocytes, where every cell had a vimentin aggregate, the fibroblasts only have a kind of a patchwork. So some fibroblasts have normal filaments and some have aggregates, and we don't know why that is. But it's a nice system because you can now compare those with and without the aggregates. And so when we did that, we found that the GAN cells that had these massive nuclear aggregates, perinuclear aggregates, so right next to the nucleus, accumulated more of the messenger RNA of the KLHL16 gene, which should be exported out of the nucleus to become translated into protein. And interestingly, what we find in GAN patients is they all have very little or no gigaxin in protein, regardless of what kind of mutation they express. So I think, with Rachel's work, really our main focus was to develop this human cellular model to study GAN, but unexpectedly, it led us to this focus now on the mRNA of the gene, which nobody has considered prior to this.
I was thinking of this philosophically too, just thinking back on the paper. We set out to study proteostasis and proteins, and then we end the paper with this finding that, again, mRNA might be affected.
It's time for a take-home message.
So the take-home message from Rachel's MBOC paper is that patient-derived cellular models of rare diseases such as GAN and Alexander disease are an incredible tool to help us unravel the early mechanisms that contribute to disease pathology and ultimately help guide us to a therapy that's targeting the right thing at the right time. And I know that this is a long road, but I have high hopes because the phenotypes that we uncovered are just so striking, and we're excited to keep going.
Rachel, you get the last word.
Well, Natasha did a great job, but I guess I'd also point out that, based on our findings with Vimentin, it could be that this is potentially a new target to look into in Alexander disease and GAN.
Thank you both. Please send questions to amessing@wisc.edu, and we'll try our best to address them in a future podcast. That's all for today's episode of Alexander Disease Research Update. Thanks for listening, and thank you to Natasha and Rachel for joining me today.
Thank you, Albie.
Thanks for having us.
Our theme song was written by Charlie Allinson, special technical assistance from my daughters Zoe and Rebecca, and from Clark Kellogg at the UW's Waisman Center. And thanks to our donors for these podcasts, the Barrett-Riddle family. I'm Albie Messing. See you next time.